Welcome to the Bloomberg P&L Podcast. I'm Paul Sweeney, along with my co-host, Lisa Abramowitz.
Each day, we bring you the most noteworthy and useful interviews for you and your money, whether you're at the grocery store or the trading floor.
Find the Bloomberg P&L Podcast on Apple Podcasts or wherever you listen to podcasts, as well as at Bloomberg.com. Well, we are 10 plus years into this economic cycle. We've got a Fed on the sideline. We've had great returns in 2019. What do we do in 2020? Well, there's nobody better to chat about that on the fixed income side than Tad Revelle. Tad is Chief Investment Officer for Fixed Income for TCW, a little firm out on the West Coast, $170 billion under management. He joins us here in our Bloomberg Interactive Broker Studio. So, Tad, I know you wrote recently about a liquidity crisis. What do you mean by a whenever I see the word crisis, it grabs my attention, having lived through the financial crisis of 2008. What do you mean by a liquidity crisis?
Maybe we should parse that a little bit. I think the point that's trying to be made is that all economic cycles, all asset price cycles ultimately end in some type of a crisis. Doesn't necessarily have to be of the scale as we saw in 2008, but let me give you a quick example about why it's almost inevitable. It's part of the human DNA, if you will. So most everyone has probably or perhaps had the experience of looking at a house to buy, perhaps in a hot market. So what's that world like? The moment that the house gets listed, you show up on the door and so do 20 other people. And maybe you're thinking, I'm putting my whole life savings into this home and I need to do my due diligence and ask a lot of questions. I want to ask about the roof, the foundation, maybe the crazy neighbors who live next door. And the seller, if you are able to buttonhole him, is going to look at you like you've got two heads. He's going to look at you and he's going to say, hey, I've got 20 people here. I only want to hear from you how much over offer side price you want to pay, all cash. Otherwise, don't waste my time. The point is that in a bull market, in a booming market, you don't get to do your due diligence. You don't get to ask questions. Okay, fast forward a couple of years. Now maybe the market is stone cold. Maybe you bought the house. So you wait a couple of weeks after listing and one barely qualified buyer walks in the door and he wants to do his due diligence. And he's not going to accept non-answers to questions about the roof and the foundation. And every time you can't answer a question, he's going to make a worst case assumption about it. And so consequently, ultimately, when that buyer, recognizing that he's got market power, wants to potentially place an offer on your property, there's going to be a huge disagreement between you, the seller, who says, hey, I paid X, the market's down maybe 5%, but what you're talking about is paying me down 20%.
Right.
So I'll call that a liquidity crisis. Does that happen in the credit markets? Think about the drive-by deals that were prevalent, if not ubiquitous, in 2017, and think ahead to the possibility that in a cooler or cold credit market, we probably will face some type of a liquidity crisis where the buyers say, I got in at par, I'll sell you down a few points, but I'm not going to pay 60, I'm not going to allow you to take this credit off my hands at 65 cents on the dollar. And by the way, you've already seen a lot of single name idiosyncratic volatility. So I think that if this sounds a little theoretical, just take a look at some of the market action in high yield in the loan space over the last year. It might disabuse you of that idea.
That's where I wanted to go. Have you seen any meaningful evidence that maybe we are in or approaching liquidity crises in any major of the fixed income markets that TCW plays in?
Well, I think we are actually. And as I mentioned, there's certainly been a significant amount of single name volatility in the loan space. We could take or make a few statements about the high yield market because I think that's very instructive. What you're seeing in the high yield market is very strange. Or how do I say it? If you look at the performance of the triple C bond class, the triple C bonds are up on a total return basis year to date, something like 4 to 5%. The high yield market overall on average is up double digits. The equity market, as you pointed out, is, I don't know, north of 15% on a year to date basis. Who would have expected the triple C asset class to have so badly underperformed in what would otherwise appear to be such a positive risk here? I think what it speaks to is that the market is discriminating between risk. And once it starts discriminating between risk, you are perhaps well on your way towards stepping into an environment that will be, a liquidity crisis of some kind.
Give us a sense of the credit quality that you're seeing out there in maybe some of the more leveraged loan space or the high yield space where we probably would see some concerns first.
The overall level of credit quality, it's poor. And there's many different ways that you can sort of view that or understand that. So maybe the simplest way is just to recognize that in the high yield space, naturally, the lending traditionally is done with covenants, right? That you, when you lend money to a levered enterprise, you attempt to tie the hands of management so that it can't take the money that you lent them and do things that you don't want them to do as a bondholder. Your relationship with a company as a bondholder is contractual. And if you don't specify in the contract that you, management, can't take the money I gave you, buy back stock, pay yourself dividends, sell my collateral, sell, which is to say a division of yep. the business and pay yourself, well, then you don't really have the ability to restrict them. So according to Moody's, covenant quality is as bad as it has been in a very long period of time. If you look at the amount of leverage that's gone into it, into that marketplace, measured by debt to earnings ratios, yep. it's quite high. And then if you look at things that are not so easily measured but more disturbing, it's things like the add-backs that we're seeing, the EBITDA add-backs.
Tad Revelle, thank you so much for joining us with some interesting comments on the credit side. Chief Investment Officer of Fixed Income for TCW, joining us here in our Bloomberg Interactive Brokers studio, giving us some thoughts about perhaps a liquidity crisis building in certain parts of the fixed income market.
You're listening to Bloomberg Markets with Lisa Abramowitz and Paul Sweeney on Bloomberg Radio.
Well, we got some management changes coming to Alphabet or Google or Google or Alphabet, however you want to play it. Joining us to break it down is Laura Martin, Senior Analyst for Needham & Company, joining us on the phone from Los Angeles. We also have Mark Bergen, Technology Reporter for Bloomberg News. He's in our Bloomberg 960 studio in San Francisco. Mark, let's start with you. Just lay out for us what actually is happening at Alphabet / Google today.
Sure. So officially, Google, Sundar Pichai, who's been running Google for the past 4 years as CEO, is now stepping up to be also the CEO of Alphabet, which was a role that Larry Page, who was one of the co-founder, had served. And so Larry and Sergey Brin, the co-founders, are both stepping back from the company. But important to notice, they are still on the board, and they also are still the majority controlling shareholders of the special super voting Class B stock. So in a way, they still control the company. They're just sort of no longer involved and responsible.
Hey, Laura, why do you think they did this in the first place, i.e. create the Alphabet structure? Why were they doing it in the first place?
Because I think Wall Street was really frustrated at the lack of profitability, because we think the search engine makes 90% margins. And Other Bets was a way to break out really huge loss makers with almost zero revenue. So I think that was helpful, and it added a little bit of granularity about where these enormous losses were coming from and what assets they were attributable to.
So, Laura, the stock's up 2% today. It's up 26% year to date. It seems like the market doesn't really care whether you've got Larry as the CEO of Alphabet and whether you have an Alphabet or whether Sundar's doing everything. Is it just all about the search business?
I mean, I think it should be. I think at Google, we agree with the government that Google should be broken up, and the first thing they should do is spin off YouTube, because we think YouTube alone would be worth about $300 billion,
wow.
which would leave about $500 billion behind. And we get more granularity and different forms of investors. We really do have a streaming, as we've seen from Disney hitting all-time highs, there really is a set of investors who want to invest in the streaming world globally, and YouTube dominates that space. So it would get a much higher multiple if it wasn't part of the Google search conglomerate.
Hey, Mark, you are out with a story here. Google's founders give up on being the Warren Buffett of tech. What do you mean by that?
When they announced Alphabet 4 years ago, they talked about how they went to visit Warren Buffett, and they had this sort of Berkshire Hathaway model, right? This was, at this point, they were working on autonomous cars for years. They had two different companies working on biotech and healthcare, including one working on something as ambitious as a life extension. And they sort of wanted to build this model where, Google, the internet business, could be sort of isolated and not have to deal with these on a managerial level, but also sort of show Wall Street how much they're spending on what they call the other bets. And that model, as we understood it, and as the company talked about it for a long time, was you're going to have independent CEOs reporting up to this company that then allocates capital depending on sort of the prospects of the business. That's changed, where you now have the CEO of the company responsible for 99% of the revenues and most of the employee base, Google, now running all of Alphabet.
Laura, what I love about your career, and you've had a long career covering media and these tech stocks, is you make some great bold calls, innovative calls. And, you know, thinking about spinning out YouTube would certainly be a bold move for Alphabet. What do you think the company and management is thinking about any kind of spin out of some of their assets?
I think founders tend to love the assets they build or buy. In the case of YouTube, they bought it and it was a brilliant acquisition. I think professional managers, which is what we have at Google as of today, are much more willing to follow economics. And therefore, I believe that Google will be more likely to be willing to spin off pieces under a non-founder oversight, which is what we have today.
Laura, do you think the founders, Larry and Sergey, how critical are they, do you think, from investors' perspective to this company and the stock?
Not very much. Mostly they spend money. Mostly they spend money on passion projects that we think should be part of their multi-billion dollar net worth.
Mark, what do you think, you know, when you take a look at Google, what do you think is the next step for them? Is there anything transformational for them?
I think the big next step is going to be an interesting question is, right, so Sundar has put a lot of emphasis on the cloud business, and that's where they're spending a lot of their investment, their headcount, money to build this business to compete with Amazon and Microsoft. That's been, you know, about 4 years now. They're still in third place. I think I'm not sure how long it seems like a pretty long rope, but at some point they have to sort of show Sundar and the board and shareholders that they're actually making significant progress on this investment. And they're going up against a couple issues, right? Some of the industries they're moving into, like the federal contracts and military contracts, oil and gas industry, has actually prompted quite a bit of resistance from rank and file Google engineers. And so dealing with that internal tension, which has been percolating for a couple of years now, is also going to be a major challenge for Sundar, and something that he's pretty much dealt with on his own. Not really, the founders have not been involved in that at all.
Mark Bergen, technology reporter, thank you so much for joining us. Mark covers all things tech for Bloomberg News, joining us from our Bloomberg 960 studio in San Francisco. And Laura Martin, senior analyst at Needham Company. She has a buy on the stock. She's been right, as she typically is. We appreciate you calling in, Laura, from Los Angeles, where you're based. Google stock, again, very strong performer this year, up 26%, making some management changes there.
Bloomberg Opinion, informed perspectives, and expert data-driven commentary on breaking news.
It's 10:33 on Wall Street. Time to check in with Bloomberg Opinion. We're joined by Ellen Wald, president of Transversal Consulting and a Bloomberg Opinion contributor, joining us now from Vienna at the OPEC meeting. Ellen, thanks so much for joining us. We appreciate you making the effort all the way from Vienna. So you're at the OPEC meeting. Give us a sense of what is going on there right now.
Well, right now, we're still waiting for for all of the ministers to arrive. Some of them, I think, are not even supposed to arrive until early tomorrow morning. But there's a lot of chatter about potentially putting together some sort of production cut. We've definitely heard Iraq talking about that. The thing is that putting that together is going to be a really hard sell at this point. Tomorrow morning, we're going to have the Joint Ministerial Monitoring Committee, and then finally in the afternoon, the actual OPEC meeting itself. So there is time to potentially put together some sort of deeper production cut. I think the ministers are particularly concerned about demand weakness in the first half of 2020, and the fact that right now the cuts are extended through March, but they want to at least get a rollover through June. I think we might even see one through the end of 2020, though.
Interesting. I'm sure you're aware, we had real strong performance here in Brent crude, up about 3.4% today. What is your sense, Ellen, about the cohesion of OPEC these days? How efficient are they at really kind of managing the market?
Well, this is a really difficult situation because, like we saw a couple of days ago on Friday after Thanksgiving, crude just plummeted, and now today we're seeing it up. This really, I think, is due much more to the headlines coming out about the China trade negotiations, much more so than any chatter from OPEC. I think that OPEC is really in this market and this atmosphere where things are really being determined by the global economic outlook and demand. It's not really so much about supply. And so OPEC may have had a very presciently timed headline in terms of talking about putting together further cuts, but I do think most people realize that those cuts are very unlikely to materialize, and the price action we're seeing could be largely due to the talk on China.
Exactly. So what when I think about OPEC, we also have to talk about Russia. How is Russia performing and acting in the marketplace right now? And what's kind of the relationship between Russia and OPEC right now?
Yeah, Russia is essentially the deal maker for OPEC at this point. In fact, last year in December, OPEC itself could not come to any sort of consensus, even to just extend what they already had in place, until Russia showed up the next day, sat down with the Saudis, sat down with the Iranians, and only then did we get a rollover in the status quo. So Russia really plays a crucial role at this point, particularly since the previous Saudi oil minister who put together this current deal, Al-Faleh, is no longer part of the Saudi government anymore. And we have this new Saudi oil minister who, while has played a very large role in the Saudi delegation, has never really sat at the head before. So people are really looking to see what kind of force he's going to bring to the negotiations. I think the big meeting we're looking for at OPEC is going to be the meeting between Russian oil minister Novak and the new Saudi oil minister, Prince Abdulaziz Ibn Salman.
So, Ellen, let's switch gears just a little bit and talk about the other big, big news in the energy world, and that is the Aramco IPO. There's news reports out that Saudi Aramco is considering pricing its IPO at the top end of the marketed range. What's the latest from your perspective on this huge IPO?
Yeah, I'm not surprised to hear that they want to price it at the large end or at the higher end. We're supposed to get word on pricing at the same time as the OPEC meeting, which should be interesting. Though shares, we don't know when shares are scheduled to start trading. What's been going on with this IPO is we've seen pretty strong demand within Saudi Arabia, but not as strong as it was billed as. And typically, a lot of IPOs are oversubscribed many more times than what we've seen so far with the Aramco IPO. But there's an interesting dynamic here between what's going to happen with OPEC and this IPO. I think there's a general assumption that you want a higher price for oil for the Aramco IPO. It's really not likely that Saudi Arabia is able to push through or to galvanize enough support to cut production enough to really increase the price of oil right now, particularly since it's reacting so much more to China trade than anything in OPEC. So I do think that what we have to understand is from here on out, once Aramco is a public company, Aramco will want to show revenue growth. And the best way, at least in this oil market, to show revenue growth is to pump more. And so every time OPEC comes up, there'll be an incentive for Saudi Arabia to pump more oil as opposed to less. And this could become an issue, particularly when Saudi Arabia wants to sell more shares of Aramco, as it has indicated it wants to. And this could really shift the OPEC dynamic in a very new way that we haven't seen thus far.
Ellen, just really quickly, 20 seconds. How concerned are people there at OPEC that this deal is only being done, it's not being done in the West? There's no U.S. or Western investors.
Well, I think a lot of people have kind of said, you know, this is a Saudi thing. It's a Saudi, or it's a regional story. That's really what I heard. This is now a regional rather than an international story. Though I do think it will continue to affect the market and will have major effects on the Saudi economy and the regional economy going forward.
Dr. Ellen Wald, thank you so much for joining us. Dr. Wald is the president of Transversal Consulting, also a non-resident senior fellow at the Atlantic Council's Global Energy Center and a Bloomberg Opinion columnist. You can read more on this and other stories from Bloomberg Opinion at Bloomberg.com/opinion. And for the folks on the terminal, you can type in O-P-I-N, go to get all of the great opinion work coming out of Bloomberg Opinion. Again, looking at crude, a very, very strong day for crude here. Up about 3.5% looking at Brent and WTI. And as Dr. Wald mentioned, probably driven more by positive tone of trade talks than about more so than what's happening in Vienna at the OPEC meetings. But we will follow up on those meetings.
This is Bloomberg Markets with Lisa Abramowitz and Paul Sweeney on Bloomberg Radio.
I've got an amazing story for you. I just heard this amazing story over the last couple of minutes. Rob LoCascio, founder, chief executive officer of LivePerson. It's a publicly traded company. LPSN is the symbol. He joins me here in a Bloomberg Interactive Broker studio, and they do some type of communication, AI-powered, conversational. I don't want to do that right now. Rob, your company went public. I was just looking on the Bloomberg terminal. April of 2000,
Now, for those of you who don't know, April of 2000 was the absolute peak, maybe just past the peak of the dot-com cycle. How did you guys go public, and how did you survive?
$2 million in revenues and $20 million in losses. Wow. And we had a $300 million market cap, but...
We did those deals back in the day.
That's right. They were companies that went out with no revenue, you know. But we went out, and we were the last internet IPO,
wow.
April 7th of 2000. Went out at $8 a share, and within 12 months, we were 7 cents a share.
Oh.
So it got pretty hairy.
And the stock now is $37.75. You have a market cap today of $2.5 billion. Tell us what LivePerson does. What were you at your inception, and what are you today?
So I invented when you chat online for customer care. So we were on a website, in 1997.
Cool.
Patented, and then obviously took it public. But I've always had this vision, obviously, that commerce is powered by conversations. It's not just a vending machine. You know, you have to go and talk to somebody, ask questions. So that's how we sort of built the business. But about 6 years ago, I made a really big bet. And we said AI and bots and automation will power these conversations, much like we see with Alexa. So we decided to pivot the company, build a whole new platform, and launch it in the world and allow every brand in the world to have that sort of power of the Alexa, but have it for your brand. And now you can run it on every messaging front end. So through Apple Business Chat or Facebook, you can message a brand like Delta Airlines, and you can now ask a question instead of being put on hold.
So who else is in this space? Because, I mean, I would think that every tech company, or there'd be a lot of technology companies in there kind of playing in the space.
So there's a massive shift going on from e-commerce to what we call conversational commerce. And Apple, Facebook, Google, and Amazon are all betting that the conversational user experience is the future. And so for, obviously, Amazon, they've got Alexa.
Right.
And so everyone's betting, and for the other companies, they've got messaging front end. So all the big technology companies are in there, and we're in there with them, except we built a platform for the brands to create these very scalable, unique experiences through those front ends. So you can go through Alexa to a Delta Airlines or message through iMessage to Delta Airlines, but our platform supports Delta Airlines because you have to build a bot, you have live human agents, all that has to be on a very scalable platform, and that's what we built.
Well, is your company and others putting these customer service agents out of business?
No, contrary to what people believe, the contact center agents are actually the ones building the bots. They're the ones who know how to have conversations. They're taking calls, they're doing chats, they're doing messages. And so we empower them now to actually be on our platform, create the conversations, and deploy them. And like at Lowe's, which is one of our customers, they have a group of agents in the Dominican Republic that are making these conversations, these automations, these AIs. They're putting them in the world, and they're the ones that are doing it, not tech people. And in some cases, they've doubled their salary. So for now, if you think about the world and where it'll be, I'll be talking to my TV, I'm talking to my car, I'm going to be communicating through voice, through messaging, and there needs to be a group of people who are designing those conversational user experiences. Those are the agents today. In the future, they may get replaced, but today they're the ones powering the conversations.
So I see, I was reading something that in the future, 70% of conversations will be with bots. Give us an example of that.
Because we see today, we have 20,000 customers and some of the largest telcos and banks and retailers in the world. And we see the data set. We power 60 million conversations a month on our platform. So we see most of those conversations are pretty redundant. For instance, at a bank, 30 to 40% of calls that happen today are these conversations are related to paying your bill. Like I'm paying my credit card bill and I have questions. We know a lot of that can be automated. And the consumers want it automated. They don't want to pick up the phone. They don't want to converse. They want to have it in a conversational format. Like, I don't understand why this charge is on my bill. Okay, a question. What charge? And that's the back and forth, but that'll be automated. A lot of those will be automated.
Interesting. Wow. I'm looking at your stock again today, $37.75, up 100% this year. What were you thinking when your stock was 7 cents a share? How did you survive?
You know, survival, I've always sort of taken the quote from Winston Churchill, you know, never, never, never quit. And I just think if you have a purpose in building a company, you feel like you got to get through the tough times. And I've found is that most of the tough times is a place for learning. So a lot of entrepreneurs, they quit. You think this is terrible. And we had to fire 140 people out of 180 people in 2001 to survive. And it was a terrible thing. But going through these experiences makes you tougher. And you start working through how to build a better company. So to me, it's like I find it when you hit those rough parts, instead of getting down, it's a time to learn. And so I think psychologically, which is half the game, I've just stayed in it to learn and build a great company. And we're not there yet. You know, I think we've arrived at a place where conversational commerce will take over most of what we see in e-commerce. So I feel like we're here to own that, to drive that, and sort of to change the way technology is too. I'm not so proud of our world, of the technology leaders today, and I think we can change the game.
Rob LoCascio, just a fascinating story. Rob LoCascio, founder, chief executive officer of LivePerson. Again, this was the, as Rob mentioned, the last, you know, internet IPO to get off and get the IPO done during the internet boom. That was April of 2000. We're here 19 years later. The yeah. company's still here, you know, from 7 cents a share to 37. Just extraordinary. Rob, thanks so much.
Thanks for listening to the Bloomberg P&L podcast. You can subscribe and listen to interviews at Apple Podcasts or whatever podcast platform you prefer. I'm Paul Sweeney. I'm on Twitter at PT Sweeney.
I'm Lisa Abramowitz. I'm on Twitter at Lisa Abramowitz1. Before the podcast, you can always catch us worldwide on Bloomberg Radio.